You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Each week, I break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news, and I interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter at nonzero.org. A Chinese fighter jet flew within 50 yards of a Japanese patrol plane during military drills in the Pacific, prompting a rebuke from Japanese officials who warned that such close passes could lead to accidental collisions. China, for its part, placed the blame on Japan for its close-in reconnaissance flights aimed at surveilling Chinese military activities. The close call comes amid rising tensions in the Pacific as both China and the United States and its allies have carried out a series of military drills in recent months. Welcome to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. In a few minutes, Jake Werner, the director of the East Asia program at the Quincy Institute, will join me for an in-depth conversation about our main story of the week, which is the U.S.-China trade war. But first, here are some of this week's most important headlines. Israel launched a wide-ranging assault on Iran, killing more than 20 of Iran's senior military officials and damaging several nuclear facilities. President Trump endorsed Israel's attack in a post on Truth Social, but added that it could represent an opportunity for Iran to accept a new nuclear deal, quote, before there is nothing left, end quote. Gérard Araud, a former French ambassador to the U.S. who has taken part in Iran nuclear talks in the past, warned on Twitter that the attacks could backfire, quote, if I was Iranian Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, I would order that everything be done in order to rapidly acquire a nuclear bomb, Araud wrote. Now, this is a very rapidly developing situation, so I should note that we're taping this on Friday, June 13th in the morning, and that you should look out for further updates that may have come out in the meantime. Britain, Canada, and several other Western states issued sanctions against a pair of far-right Israeli ministers for, quote, repeated incitements of violence against Palestinian communities in the West Bank. Secretary of State Marco Rubio condemned the decision as outrageous in a post on X, adding that the U.S. stands shoulder to shoulder with Israel. Also this week, the U.S. announced sanctions of its own against several charities and civil society groups over alleged ties to Palestinian militants. The most prominent of these groups was an organization called Ad-Damir, which is an NGO that provides legal services to Palestinians detained by Israel. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte warned that if the United Kingdom doesn't hike its military spending, then British people, quote, better learn to speak Russian, end quote. The comment came after a speech in which Rutte claims that Russia could be ready to carry out military action against NATO in the next 5 years. Even some hawkish commentators viewed this as a bit of a bridge too far. British historian Mark Galeotti, for example, called Rutte's claims implausible and frankly deceptive, arguing that Russia's military struggles in Ukraine belie any possibility that Russian troops could roll through Europe. Congressman Mark Green, who chairs the House Homeland Security Committee, announced that he will leave Congress for what he called, quote, an opportunity in the private sector that was too exciting to pass up. But he will not make that move until after he has a chance to vote on a reconciliation package that is working its way through Congress. Good governance advocates told Popular Information that Green's decision poses an obvious conflict of interest, particularly since the comprehensive bill that he would be voting on has money for just about every industry. Green's decision comes just a year after Congressman Mike Gallagher, then the head of the House China Select Committee, retired from Congress after he accepted a job with Palantir, the controversial military contractor and data firm. This week brought a slight reprieve in the U.S.-China trade war, with both countries agreeing to walk back a series of restrictions on exports following 2 days of talks in London. The Trump administration agreed to allow the export of some jet engines to China and walked back a bit on its threat to ban all Chinese students from U.S. universities, while China said that it would temporarily restart exports to the U.S. of rare earth minerals, which are crucial for both American technology in general and for American military equipment in particular. An analyst at the Center for Strategic and International Studies framed the agreement as a win for Beijing, arguing that the deal shows China is, quote, in a strong position and can bear a lot of pain, and perhaps actually more pain than the United States. For more on the U.S.-China trade war, let's go now to my conversation with Jake Werner of the Quincy Institute. You can follow Jake on X at JWD Werner. That's W-E-R-N-E-R. I hope you'll stick around. Hey, Jake, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Connor. Thanks for having me on.
Happy to have you. So this week, I'll introduce you. You are Jake Werner, the director of the East Asia program at the Quincy Institute. Are there other affiliations that I should mention, or is that your main one?
I'm affiliated to Peace in the World, so that's important too.
Peace in the World. Well, Peace in the World is a very good thing to be affiliated with, though it's not really winning right now. I'm sure that a lot of people heard, we're going to be, say it again.
We're on the back foot.
And so there's obviously a lot of developments happening very actively, even as we have this conversation in the Middle East. Our main conversation is not going to be about that. It's going to be much more about the U.S.-China trade war, these latest rounds of trade negotiations that you've been watching very closely and more broadly over the past few months. But before we dive into that, I think it might be helpful to get a sense. You obviously follow China very closely, have a good sense of how it approaches foreign policy. So for listeners who are thinking about how China might respond to this crisis in the Middle East, what would you say to them?
China's basic interest in the Middle East is stability. Well, of course, this is very threatening to Chinese interests. There is kind of a line in D.C. that there's kind of an axis of adversaries or authoritarians or something, whatever the axis is, that includes China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran. And that is, there's sort of a kernel of truth in the sense that all those countries share the United States as a major threat to themselves. And so there are some alignments driven by that shared threat coming from the United States. But when it comes to the Middle East, China's interests actually are, and it does have connections with Iran, but its interests are much more with Saudi Arabia and the UAE, because fundamentally the Chinese geopolitical interest in the region and more broadly in general is a stable and prosperous global economy, because that is sort of what connects China into the rest of the world. China's political economy, the stability of political rule in China and growth in the Chinese economy, those depend on stability and growth in the global economy. So China will take this to be a very negative development. And it will take advantage of it as a sort of propaganda opening as well. It will say, the United States is a force that's destabilizing things. And China stands for stability and diplomacy. But I think the real material threat to China comes from potential destabilization of oil flows and maybe a longer term economic destabilization in a region that increasingly China considers important to its economic future.
Yeah. One quick follow up on that. So you mentioned oil flows. Obviously, China has been increasingly getting oil from Iran in the last couple of years, is my understanding. Do you have a sense of the extent to which this, like, if oil flows from Iran to China were cut off, how significant of a problem that would be?
It's less. China gets more oil from Saudi than from Iran. The big problems, I think, for China would just be destabilizing the overall market and rising prices. And China has made a big effort to try to wean itself off this dependency on overseas oil shipments. So it's by no means is it there yet, but one of the motivations for the just extraordinary build out of clean energy in China is to achieve a level of energy independence that means these sorts of disruptions won't be so painful. So it is less painful now than it was, let's say, 5 years ago, but it still will be painful. both the physical disruptions and the volatility in prices in the market.
Yeah. Very interesting. Well, again, as we were talking about this over email before, and the fast moving events in the Middle East really do not make it a great podcast topic. So I'll leave it at that for now. But I appreciate you weighing in on that. So why don't we go ahead and move to our bigger topic of the week, which is, of course, the U.S.-China trade war. We saw a deal of some sort, a quote-unquote deal, reached this week that seems to put things back on track, at least, for some sort of trade negotiations. Can you talk a little bit about what that agreement is, and if it makes you feel more upbeat about U.S.-China relations than you did last week?
Yeah. Well, I mean, on the question of upbeat, maybe the thing to say with reference to the Israel attack on Iran is that this might undermine the prospects for diplomacy in the U.S.-China relationship as well, because it seems that the United States engaged in some level of deception in its negotiations with Iran, either in the short term, either giving sort of cover to Israel's attack in the last couple of days, or potentially longer, never really seriously engaging in diplomacy and just providing cover for Israel longer term. So that's a question that hasn't been settled, but there's no question that that at some point there was deception involved in the diplomacy, and China will understand that quite clearly. That said, I think that there is still hope for U.S.-China diplomacy. The path is very difficult, but so we'll kind of talk about that more. Just to sort of frame the issue here, when Trump came into office, China was cautiously optimistic that they could pull the administration into some kind of diplomatic framework. So they began sending informal delegations to D.C. You know, they started reaching out to people who might be close to Trump. They suggested some areas that might be promising for discussions between the U.S. and China, and in particular highlighted some of the sort of hobby horses that Trump is always on about, whether that's the centrality of the dollar in global economy, the trade deficit, of course, issues like investments, industrial and like Chinese investment in industrial manufacturing in the United States. So the whole hope on the Chinese side was that the U.S. might respond to these things. And unfortunately, what happened is the U.S. did not respond. And instead, Trump hit China with a 10% tariff increase in February and then another 10% increase in March. And in response to both of those tariff increases, and this was already on top of very high tariff levels on China coming out of the first Trump administration, and then the Biden administration largely retained those high rates and added to them a little bit in some sectors. In response to those initial tariff increases, China was very restrained because it was still looking for the possibility of opening talks somehow with the Trump administration. And then we came to Liberation Day, the day on April 2nd when Trump announced tariff increases on the whole world, including some places that are uninhabited. And China came in for, so different countries got different tariff increases. China came in for a 34% increase in tariffs. And at that point, China concluded, okay, the Trump administration is not willing to talk. They are just trying to, degrade us, to humiliate us, to like force us to come crawling to the table, and we're done with that. And so the Chinese response was to say, okay, you raise tariffs on us, we raise tariffs on you. So China imposed a 34% tariff increase. Trump kind of flipped out about that. He said, you know, as he does in all caps on his social media, he said, China panicked. That was the one thing they could not afford to do. And so then Trump raised tariff increases another, I think, 50%. And so then China said, okay. And they raised tariffs 50% on their side. And then Trump drove it up again, and China responded again. And at that point, China said, okay, the levels of tariffs are now so high that to raise it any further would be a joke. So we're done. But essentially where the tariff stood, which was well over 100% on both sides, 145% on the U.S. side, the outcome of that sort of back and forth in tariffs would have been, if it was allowed to stand, almost overnight severing of the economic relationship between the U.S. and China.
Right.
So that's where we stood for a couple of weeks. And both sides were feeling very nervous about how destabilizing this would be for their economies. Trump was expressing that anxiety publicly. He kept saying, like, Xi Jinping really wants to talk about this. He's really worried. He really wants to call me, but he's a proud man and he's having trouble calling me. But he better call me. And if he calls me, then maybe we can work it out.
It's classic Trump.
So we had this kind of like very childish kind of back and forth on the two sides. Trump even suggested at one point that he had already talked to Xi Jinping. And the reporter asked him, when did that happen? And he was like, oh, we talked. So they did not talk. But eventually, they did kind of back down. And we still don't know who called whom. But we do know that the two sides got together to reduce these absolutely devastating tariff rates on both sides. That happened in early May. And Bessent, the Treasury Secretary on the U.S. side, the Trade Representative Greer, met with the top economic official on the Chinese side, whose name is Hu Lifeng, and they agreed to bring the tariffs down to where they were before Liberation Day, with the exception of a 10% increase U.S. against China, which doesn't single out China because everybody in the world got that 10%. And so that's where we stood for a couple weeks in May, and then all of a sudden Trump threatened to blow it up again. And so he was back on social media and he said, the Chinese are not living up to their end of the bargain and they better do so, and no more Mr. Nice Guy. And that was at the end of 2 weeks ago. And so all of a sudden then it seemed like this like sort of tenuous stabilization was about to fall apart again. And it came out then subsequently that the thing Trump was complaining about is that China had not allowed the export of rare earth elements that it had agreed to at that initial initial negotiations at the beginning of May.
Right. And
so this seems to have been Trump trying to raise pressure to get China to release these rare earth elements. On the Chinese side, they said, the U.S. is not living up to its end of the bargain either, because the day after we made the agreement to bring the tariffs down and to start negotiating over these issues, the Trump administration started issuing new forms of technology restrictions against Huawei, the most important Chinese multinational company, the high-tech company with a major global presence. And then there were some restrictions on the export of jet technology, which is important because China's trying to develop its own jet airplane ecosystem, and a number of other things. And then as Trump started getting increasingly worried about this rare earths issue, then there was also this threat on the U.S. side to start revoking the visas of Chinese students in the United States.
Right.
So we have a whole range of new antagonistic measures coming out of the U.S. side starting the day after that initial agreement. And China, it looks like China once again concluded, okay, the Americans are not serious about this. And they are worried about this rare earths issue. So we're going to continue to hold this rare earths issue. And as a result of then this sort of renewal of tension and Trump demanding that China talk about this, then finally Xi Jinping did respond to Trump's request for a call, and the two of them did talk. And then they set up negotiations that happened in London this last Sunday and Monday. And the agreement, from what we can tell, because the details haven't been released, but the agreement seems to be, okay, we're basically, both sides are going to roll back those post May 12th restrictions and antagonistic measures. And so essentially we're going back to where we were on May 12th.
Right. Yeah, I'm curious if we could... I think an interesting aspect here that I want to get your thoughts on is the role of the rare earth minerals in particular, right? Because it seems like that is China's sort of primary leverage in these talks, but it seems actually like sort of extraordinary leverage. It seems like they are actually in a position to negotiate from a position of significant strength with the Trump administration.
Yeah. Yes, I'm not sure that they realized that before Trump blew up the relationship the first time. But it's clear on the U.S. side that that was one of the main issues in the first round of talks in Geneva in May, and that was overwhelmingly the main issue in this most recent round of talks in London, and so it's clear that to the Chinese side now that this is real power to exert over the Americans, and this is something that, for example, Iran did not have in the talks with the United States. Iran did not have that kind of leverage. Where the American side would become desperate if the Chinese side used it, and from the Chinese side, this is attractive because it's a kind of leverage that doesn't blow up the possibility of diplomacy. It's a kind of leverage that could actually facilitate diplomacy by getting the Americans to talk in a serious way.
Right.
So that's why I say I haven't given up all hope for diplomacy if China uses this leverage in a responsible way. So it could use it in an irresponsible way and start making really extravagant demands because they feel like we really have a lot of power now over the Americans. They're going to have to concede to us. And that, I think, would lead the whole thing to spin out of control in a very dangerous way, in a way that's not just limited to economic warfare, potentially. But there also has been a clear signal on the Chinese side that what they're really looking for is some kind of diplomatic process that could lower tensions.
Right.
The U.S.-China relationship has become increasingly fraught over the last 10 years and in ways that the Chinese leadership does not like because as I mentioned earlier, the core geopolitical interest for China is economic stability and growth in the global economy, because that's the foundation of growth and legitimacy in the Chinese domestic system. And for the United States to be sort of ripping up that system is very threatening to China. So China wants to establish stability in the global system. It wants to get away from the kinds of technological restrictions that the United States has been trying to place on China that are making it difficult for Chinese companies to develop, to make money, for the Chinese economy as a whole to develop and grow. These are the kinds of things that they want to facilitate, and they could potentially use this leverage to try to get there. So whether the Trump administration is capable of going there with them is another question. But that kind of leverage, I think, could be used in a responsible way that would save the possibility of diplomacy rather than allowing Trump's impulses to throw it away.
Yeah, it's such an interesting problem, I guess, because your argument here is that China's essential position is that they are trying to, like you said, promote economic stability. Ideally, they really don't want necessarily these back and forths on trade where they're suddenly being cut off from different markets and it's just not advantageous to them. And at the same time, it's hard to not respond as a very powerful country to things that the US president does to you, right? Like it's this interesting position that they're in where sort of if they fail to respond, it just makes them seem quite weak. But if they do respond, it risks pushing us down a path that is probably not beneficial to either side.
Yeah, that's right. They're in a difficult position, and I think that the kind of sense of insecurity that has been very strong within the Chinese leadership, and not just because of the sense of hostility from the most powerful country in the world that has developed very strongly over the last decade, but also because they feel that the Chinese system itself is somewhat fragile. Xi Jinping came to power in 2012 in a context where there were major protests going on around China. So these were not hooked up into a national movement, but locally there were protests going on all over the country over a whole range of issues, including labor, abuses of labor, of workers, poisoning of rivers, the like corruption amongst local cadres and just like really horrific incidents where powerful people sort of wielded their own impunity over regular people. There was a sense of crisis within the Chinese leadership that the party was losing its legitimacy, that the economy was running into problems, particularly after the 2008 financial crisis, when export markets became, which had previously been the real basis of the Chinese economy, export markets became a lot more stagnant, and that meant there had to be a move to more internal growth. The form that growth took largely was a gigantic real estate bubble. And unlike the Americans 10 years earlier, when they were inflating their real estate bubble, the Chinese knew full well that what they were doing was very dangerous, that real estate bubble could come down at any time and unleash a financial crisis that would really destroy the economy. So the Chinese leadership for a long time has felt under siege, both internally and externally. And that makes them respond in ways that are often counterproductive. They are oversensitive to threats. They respond in sort of repressive ways to internal dissent. They respond aggressively to the sense that external actors are threatening them or not respecting them. And just in general, because China has been subordinate within the global system for hundreds of years, there's kind of a sense of like kind of a sense of grievance, a very strong sense of grievance within the leadership. And as the Chinese economy has risen, as China has become increasingly powerful, you get the reaction on the part of the United States as well as the other rich countries saying China is threatening the system, China is doing it wrong, China is abusing its people, it's aggressive overseas. And oftentimes there's real substance to those criticisms, but the way that China perceives them is, oh, here's the rich countries. Here's the countries that victimized us for 100 years, dominated our territory, plundered our riches. The imperialist powers, right? The rich countries today are overwhelmingly the imperialist powers of the 19th century. Almost the same set of countries that occupied Beijing in 1900 in reaction to the Boxer Uprising. And fought wars against China in the 19th century. And this memory is strong in China. And so when these same imperialist powers come and say, China is doing it wrong, China is acting unfairly, is wrecking the system, is a revisionist power, all of these allegations, to Chinese ears, that's, okay, these people, finally, we're resuming our rightful position of status and power in the global system. And these people don't like it because they have unfairly had that status and power themselves.
Right.
So you get a set of dynamics where Chinese leaders can be very defensive, can overreact a lot of times. And they feel, because of this sense of siege, that when the United States or other powers that they often interpret, I think wrongly, but often interpret as proxies of the United States, for example, the Philippines in the South China Sea disputes, when they feel that these powers are not respecting them or acting contrary to their interests, they act very forcefully against that, because they say, or they're thinking, we don't want to be pushed around. If we give ground here, they're going to keep pushing. And a lot of times that's a fair judgment. So I think we're in kind of a dangerous situation where the animosities have not spun out of control yet. We're not yet at the point, where Israel and Iran have been for a long time. But we're going in that direction. And if right. The United States and China go in the direction that Israel and Iran have already been in now for some time, the consequences for the U.S. and China and for the world are going to be absolutely catastrophic, because we're talking about the two most powerful countries in the world, both of whom have very intense global interests. If they decide that they have to fight each other, that's going to destabilize the entire world and cause tremendous destruction.
Right. And I want to come back to the possibility of destabilizing the entire world and tremendous destruction, because that is obviously something that's worth digging into in much more detail. But I think maybe the path to us finding out if we're headed towards tremendous destruction is to try to understand something that is very hard to understand, which is the Trump administration's perspective on all of this. So maybe there's ways to disaggregate this into different people, because Trump sort of has his own approach that is not necessarily super consistent. I guess among his advisors and with Trump himself, do you see this as fundamentally an administration that wants to heighten some of these tensions and heighten this escalation with Beijing, or do you see it as one that's capable of walking things down?
You're right to point the distinction between Trump and a lot of his officials, because I think he really represents something unusual and unique within the Trump administration. He I think, really just wants to kind of exert his own power, feel like he's in a position of dominance, gain the respect of people who he thinks are powerful, such as Xi Jinping, and sort of show to himself that he is powerful because other powerful people respect him. And I think these psychological dynamics are very important because he wields so much power over his administration, you know, in contrast to the first administration, and over the American state as the Trump administration is centralizing power in the executive. And of course the foreign policy portfolio has always been dominated by the executive. So these sorts of, desires and impulses on his part, I think are important to understand. And then when it comes to the sort of the substance of what he's looking for, I don't think he's completely indifferent, but I think he has a great deal of flexibility in terms of what he would accept as a good deal. And in contrast to the unified perspective of the Biden administration, and in contrast to most of Trump's own officials, he is not hung up on issues of geopolitical power, of the kinds of power that come from supply chain dominance. So these core issues of military and economic power, who is going to dominate the systems that allow them to wield this power? That is something that I think he is not so sensitive to. The things that he cares about are these kinds of like superficial markers of a healthy society. And he's not thinking very clearly about how you get to those superficial markers. So things I have in mind are like trade surpluses, like a strong industrial sector, like his money flowing into his bank accounts, right? And so I think in an interesting way, he doesn't care that much about how you set that up. He just kind of wants that directly. And he thinks he can get that directly by sort of squeezing the people the other countries that he's talking to. Now, I think in contrast, many of his officials are looking at the systematic power that comes from geopolitical structures in the Western Pacific, and questions around Taiwan and the South China Sea are very important there. Many of his economic officials are looking at how control over supply chains or specific strategically important technologies would allow the United States to dominate China or vice versa. And so for them, a lot of times they're looking for policies that are intrinsically threatening to China, that kind of push a zero sum logic. One side or the other is going to win, and there's not really space for both sides to succeed. They're pushing those policies because they have these kinds of concerns about whether the U.S. or China is going to dominate the other based on systematic military and economic power. Right. And so if those officials went out, then I think there probably is no possibility for diplomacy with China. And there probably is no possibility for a peaceful future for the U.S. Because once you pose the absolute foundational sources of power, military and economic power, as a zero-sum struggle between the two most powerful countries in the world, it is very hard to find a way out of that, right? Unless suddenly space opens up in those systems for reasons that are unrelated to the actions of the U.S. and China, then the two countries are headed for conflict. So if those officials went out, or if we returned to democratic presidents and who govern in the same way as the Biden administration, both of those sets, I think, point towards conflict because they double down on a zero-sum understanding of the U.S.-China relationship. I don't think that Trump can get us out of those zero-sum pressures that are real. They're not just like a product of Cold War thinking, for example, like China sometimes says the U.S. You're just stuck in the Cold War. Like, change your thing. I don't think that's the reason that the U.S. is thinking this way. You know, most of these people, you'd barely remember the Cold War. I think rather there are genuine zero-sum pressures in the global system. And I don't think that Trump's approach to these things gets us away from that that structure that's pushing the two countries against each other. But Trump's way could buy us time, could move us off the path to conflict in the short term. I think there are some possibilities for opening up new possibilities on the issues that Trump cares about, even though that's relatively small.
Right. And what could you explain a little bit more in detail what you mean by zero-sum pressures in the international system? Like, what are these structural forces that you view as increasing tensions between the U.S. and China?
Yeah. So I think the easiest place to see this is in the global economy. And the global economy was growing quite robustly in a way that integrated the U.S. and China together and made growth in the U.S. supportive of growth in China and vice versa, up until the 2008 financial crisis. And after the 2008 financial crisis, you had a breakdown in that form of growth because the rich countries, which had really driven export-led development in China and other developing countries, but most importantly China, the rich countries were stagnant after that. So Europe in particular, but the United States as well, did not return to robust growth for a decade after the 2008 financial crisis, which meant the strategy of exporting to the rich countries and drawing investment into China and then driving the economy upward by through technological advance through that process, that broke down after 2008. At the same time, in response to that crisis, China undertook a very significant stimulus that in part led to the inflation of this dangerous property bubble, but that also a lot of those resources were channeled into industrial policy that accelerated the pace at which Chinese companies started to rise up the value chain. They started to produce in sectors that previously American companies had really dominated. And those American companies had either produced in China or they had exported to China. So for example, things like construction equipment. So all of a sudden, Chinese companies are starting to compete with American companies in sectors that American companies had previously dominated. And from the Chinese perspective, this is only fair. Like, it's not fair that the rich countries get to control all of the high value sectors, which is the thing that makes them rich. And everybody else in the world, which is, you know, more than 2/3 of the world, gets locked out of these high value sectors. So from China's perspective, this is perfectly acceptable. And it was the direction that they were aiming for all along, even if they got there faster than they intended because the export-oriented model got cut off. But from the American perspective, this is very threatening, particularly in context where the American economy suddenly is not growing. So if the American economy is not growing, if there are these populist political pressures building up in ways that are related to that economic stagnation, and at the same time, some of the most high-value American companies that are the foundation of what's left of American growth, if those are suddenly under threat from China, then this whole thing starts to look very scary, right? And from the perspective of the American elite, so I mentioned the Chinese elite has been feeling very, very insecure. The American elite has been feeling very insecure too, and for basically the same reason. The form of political legitimacy and economic growth that they had relied on from the 80s until 2008, that was starting to break down. And they don't have, I don't think they have a clear sense of why that happened. They certainly never engaged in the kind of self-reflection that would have allowed them to understand the problems as coming from within that system. And instead, the way that they started to understand it was, oh, this is because of China. It's because of the pressure that China is putting on us. And it's not, they're not wrong, exactly. But a wider view of things would understand that it's not exactly just China by itself. It's China within the context of a larger global economy that has become stagnant, that has lost its dynamism.
Right.
And if the US and China were to work together on that larger framework, rather than working against each other to see who could survive within the terms of a framework that was closing in on them, then a different path would be possible.
Well, I guess, yeah, that's a question. You sort of started to answer a question that I had there at the end, which is like, to what extent does China actually have carrots to offer to the U.S. alongside these economic questions? It seems like in a perfect world, in an ideal world, if Trump's goal was to reindustrialize, there's a certain amount of capital in China that probably wouldn't mind being invested here in the U.S. if it got them significant returns, things like that. Like, what would it look like for more of a kind of win-win deal like that to take shape?
Yeah, so I mentioned some of Trump's concerns, the trade deficit, the position of the U.S. currency in the global economy. These are things that I think China could make offers on that might look good to Trump, but they wouldn't really address any of these underlying problems in the way the global economy has been functioning. And I think what you mentioned is the more promising possibility. So I don't think it really gets to the deep problems here, but one of Trump's obsessions is this idea that we have lost our industry and we need to reindustrialize. As you say, there are a lot of Chinese companies. The Chinese economy has really been driven by manufacturing for a long time, alongside that property bubble. But the main priority of the Chinese leadership for the last 5 years has been bring down that property bubble and moving capital into advanced manufacturing instead. And that has been significantly successful. So there still are real problems in the Chinese economy because it relied so much on that property bubble and because the consumer demand within the economy has never really recovered. So the Chinese government is still facing major economic problems. And it's creating new problems for itself by focusing on manufacturing because the rest of the world is starting, not just the United States, but the rest of the world is starting to feel threatened by China completely dominating the future of the manufacturing industry. So there are some real problems here. But one possibility this opens is that some of the more advanced Chinese manufacturing companies could bring not just capital to the United States, but also technology and know-how. And these are places, there are certain sectors where the U.S. has fallen behind. And these sectors are important for the future of growth in the United States. So there could be sort of a reversal of the way that China developed. Basically, the way that China developed is that it brought foreign investment and it conditioned that foreign investment and access to the Chinese market on technology transfer from these advanced companies to Chinese companies, right? And this is something that American officials have called coerced technology transfer. They call it intellectual property theft. And there have been genuine like industrial espionage sort of operations that engage in the theft of technology. But a lot of the technology was transferred voluntarily as part of the agreement that you get access to a market in exchange for transferring this technology and training our people on it. And that's our China. That's one core reason that China is the only major economy that has seen significant sort of like breakthrough growth over the last 40 years. Every other developing country hasn't achieved this level of development. So from the standpoint of China, this was a success. From the standpoint of global economy, this was a success because if China hadn't been growing like this, the sources of demand in the global economy would have collapsed much sooner than they did, not in 2008, but before them.
Right.
But from the American perspective, this is eroding our competitive advantage. It's not fair. We should have been on top of the global system forever. And China is challenging that, and that's not acceptable. There's a different way to approach this, which is that China could teach us something just like we taught China something. And that's actually good. It's actually good to diffuse technology and increase the ability of the global economy to create wealth and to make people richer. That's actually good. So it doesn't have to be seen in zero-sum terms. And there are practical applications for this, which is we could tell some of these advanced Chinese manufacturing companies, we welcome your investment, but it has to be premised on the transfer of technology and know-how. You need to train our people on this stuff, and our companies need to be able to operate at this advanced level as well. So I think that's something that Trump actually talked about in the campaign as an idea. So it's something that he himself has contemplated. The big obstacle, however, here is that the places where China is more advanced than the United States are precisely those industries that American companies neglected. So China sort of jumped at the Chinese companies, and the industrial policy that the Chinese government designed was meant to take advantage of those openings that were left by companies in the rich countries. The rich countries' companies, and this is the United States, but of course also Europe and Japan and South Korea, those companies so dominated the industries that they were active in that it was very hard for upstart companies from other countries to become competitive. And that was not true in these kinds of neglected sectors. Most prominently things like solar panels and wind turbines and electric vehicles and the batteries that are needed for electric vehicles, the batteries that are needed to store the energy produced by clean energy build out. So the places where China has become very competitive are also the places that Republican politicians often dismiss, right? These are green technologies. And one impulse within the Trump administration and within the Republican Party more broadly has been to say, if we transition our economy to clean energy, that's going to help China. We need to double down on dirty energy because that's where America is strong. And so there is an opening. There's a business case to be made that if American companies can't become competitive in electric vehicles and in batteries, and not necessarily solar panels is such a low value industry that that's not necessarily the case, but some of the kind of attended technologies that help you run an efficient clean energy transmission system and electric grid, these are places that American companies could become very important and make a lot of money. There is resistance in the Republican Party because it's clean energy, but there is a strong business case for it. So I think this is kind of a debate that hasn't really developed within the United States yet. And one early indication in the in the so-called Big Beautiful Bill is basically an elimination of most clean energy subsidies that the Biden administration and Congress had put together through the Inflation Reduction Act. So that would really damage the possibilities for this kind of an industrial strategy that could also improve U.S.-China relations. It could work economically for the United States, could also work in terms of international relations. The indications are not great at this point, but I think there still is a case to be made to business interests, to Republican politicians. And if it were done the right way, Democrats would support it too, because it's green energy, because it would create American jobs. If the investment coming from China were included union neutrality agreements and basically encouraged the organizing of the workforces of these factories, you could get union support for this too. And it's that kind of an agreement that I think could open up space for a different way to view China, that China is not just the fundamental threat to everything that Americans stand for, but that China is a country that shares a lot of interests with the United States. And we could actually be working together on a lot of these issues in ways that would take us off the path to conflict and would open up space so that we didn't feel like it was this existential struggle anymore.
Well, that's certainly a very attractive path from my perspective. I'm kind of curious how you think about, there's a certain way in which it's hard to picture us sort of walking down from where things are right now, right? Because the view on the Republican side and even among many Democrats now is that basically any expansion of U.S.-China economic relations will open up opportunities for Chinese spying and other things like that. From the U.S. perspective, are dangerous because it's kind of a circular logic, but it is the way that they view it, which is that, you know, tensions are getting higher, so we have to respond to the fact that tensions are getting higher by acknowledging this new situation and moving forward as an adversary rather than as a potential partner. So how do you kind of deal with that?
This was a free preview of Non-Zero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at nonzero.org.